Ray.
Why, hello, David.
How you doing?
Doing great. Big changes in my life, but hey.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What, are you retired, or are you growing whiskers? I started growing whiskers in third grade,
but I'm an old bald man. But no, we closed the gallery down. The Soho Coho is no moho. So, so big change there. But we're still doing online stuff, and I'm not retired. That is not in the artist job description. I will be
of course
drawing dinosaurs till I'm dead. So.
Fantastic. And then you're going to split your time between the Ketchikan, Alaska, and
this other place. The other place.
What's it called? Kansas?
Somewhere.
It starts with an L.
Lindsborg.
Lindsborg, Kansas.
Yes, where I went to college. It's a little arty town of 3,800 people. And we'll live.
Fantastic.
We'll stay there part time, but I get to go. I'll be in the fossil beds all the time then.
Well, I hope to visit you when you're there.
Let me know that you're coming, and I'll prepare, Dave. I'll warn the town, the populace.
No,
it's a very small town.
I'll show up on your doorstep.
So when things are going rough for you, you've always got a place to stay, Dave. So
fantastic. So I've been invited to the Museum of the Rockies Dinos and More event in April.
Dinos and More. So it's not just dinosaurs. Yeah. It's the more, too.
Yeah, but more as in Museum of the Rockies. So it's more, M-O-R.
I get it. I was slow on the uptake there. Oh.
And I hope to interview some collections people and people behind the scenes that don't normally share the spotlight with fellow paleontologists. And you'll be in Kansas then, so we can do our interviews and Zoom just like we normally do.
So that's exciting. You're going. Yeah, you're going to the Museum of the Rockies in April. That I'm so excited and a little bit jealous. So.
Well, that'll probably spawn a couple interviews for paleontologists.
Yeah,
it'll be
that's
great.
That's great. And yeah, today we have a super exciting guest. I've been after him for a while. He's extremely busy doing all kinds of things. He's the director of a museum, a huge museum.
Which I didn't realize has almost as many artifacts in their collections department as the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Something like in the 20 million plus.
It is a huge, it's not only a public facility. There's a huge, it's a public collection in the back room that rivals the Smithsonian. Yeah, it's the West Coast Smithsonian, if you will. In a way, it's the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, and it's in the Golden Gate Park area. And it is phenomenal. I was lucky enough to have one of the biggest exhibits of my life was there in 1995. So
what exhibit was that?
That was Dancing to the Fossil Record and opened there in 95.
Right.
And then it went on to a few other museums.
Did you have dancers?
We had a mermaid at the opening. She didn't dance very well.
Was it a real mermaid?
Well,
it was
a person dressed up as a mermaid. She came, champagne and stuff. It was a big party. But, the Cal Academy after that, that's what they call it for short. After that.
Cal Academy.
And the Steinhardt Aquarium is there.
Right.
Not too long after that, in the early 2000s, they actually rebuilt the whole thing. Basically kind of made it part of the landscape.
Now, sustainable building.
Yes, it's incredible.
It's the most sustainable museum, I think, on the planet regarding how they have solar energy and they have grass growing all over the place. It's quite a phenomenal
What's
structure.
Cool is right in the middle of it, there's an Amazonian rainforest complete with piraraku, the giant piraraku.
No way.
Arapaimas.
Really?
Yeah, life size. Actually,
Which are the huge fish that we saw in the Amazon.
10-footers. And they have a gar tank.
Really?
They have a gar tank with 10-foot gar.
Wow.
So there's a huge fish collection. So that's kind of what drew me there in the first place. So
right. And our guest, Dr. Scott Sampson.
Our guest.
He was the presenter of the PBS Dinosaur Train, which is fantastic outreach for
He's
kids.
The host. He's Dr. Scott. Millions of kids love Dr. Scott.
Yeah. And he is going to fulfill one of my naggings with you, Ray, which
What's
was,
that?
Let's talk to a triceratops, a ceratopsian expert, which is what he is. So let's get him on the triceratopophone.
The ceratopsophone.
Oh, that's great, Ray. A ceratopsophone.
Ceratopsophone.
All right, here we go.
Hey, Dave, meet Scott Sampson. He's a paleontologist, science communicator, and author. He's the executive director of the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, California, and is widely known as Dr. Scott the paleontologist on the PBS television series Dinosaur Train. Scott, it is so great to see you again, man, and meet Dave.
Yeah,
hey. Great to see you again. And before we go any further, an amazing podcast, like 70 episodes.
Oh, thank
you. I can now say that my life is complete because I'm on Paleo Nerds, although you could just hang up on me right now and cut me off. But assuming we make it, my life will be complete. So thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to have a chance to chat with you guys.
Well, it's an honor to have you on. You're episode 72. So how about Woo-hoo. That one? Yeah. And, you know, yeah. I asked this of all of our guests. And I know you're a paleo nerd. You knew how to spell paleontology before you knew how to spell your own last name. And you started at the ripe old age of 4 years old, which is pretty cool. So we know you're a paleo nerd, but how has paleo nerdism affected your life?
Oh, my God. It's completely transformed my life. I mean, I wanted to be a paleontologist from the time I was 4, and I did it. And even when I walked away from academic paleontology, it infuses almost everything I do, including how I look at the world, the answers that I come up with for how to deal with some of the big challenges of our time. So it has totally transformed who I am. I went camping a lot as a kid. So to be able to get a job where they would pay me to travel to distant places and live in a tent and find fossils was just amazing. So yeah, wow. It has been a wonderful journey.
I want to say that when I read a little bit more about your background growing up in Vancouver, British Columbia, like I was there, I was that kid too. I was out in the backyard running off into the fields. And it's really interesting to see how both of our careers kind of started that way. And we're meandering through the past to explain the present.
Yeah, paleontology is one of these weird things because a lot of young kids grab onto it. It's yep. often the first time in their life that they have knowledge that grown-ups don't.
And that's what I mean, yeah.
It's a sense of power.
It's the power of learning. And dinosaurs are big and they're monsters and yet they're safe.
And they're real.
The big ones aren't around anymore. Kids just love them. Now, most kids actually grow up and go on to be adults. I just never happened to do that.
That's why I identify with you. You launched off your love of paleontology. You are a paleontologist, probably one of the best known paleontologists in the world. With your TV show, your super popular show, you are Dr. Scott on Dinosaur Train. How is it that ceratopsians, let's just geek out, let's go total ceratopsian. You're known in the scientific world as an expert on ceratopsians. What are they? And why are they so cool?
Ceratopsians, and the ones that I really got into in particular, the big ones, the ceratopsids, as they're called, lived in the late Cretaceous, almost entirely in North America. There's one example in Asia. And all really in that Campanian, Maastrichtian realm, for the most part, the end of the Cretaceous. And they're just incredible because they radiate into all these big and bizarre forms over a short period of time. And they tell us not only about these individual species, but about the world of dinosaurs. Some, like, we now know that you could jam pack a lot of different species of horned dinosaurs into a small area. And you could go 1,000 miles away and find another whole set of these big, bizarre horned dinosaurs.
How would you liken that to an ecosystem today?
So you go to Africa and, you know,
okay, 10 grazing different mammals in the same area.
Right, different species. So imagine if there were different species of elephants, 6 of them in the same place, or 5 of them, say, and then you could go 1,000 miles north and there'd be another 5 species of elephants. That's what we're talking about here. And so what it points to is that ecology and evolution worked differently during the hothouse world of the Mesozoic than it works today. And we don't even know exactly what that means, but wow. Species packing and species ecology was different back then. And I think we're just scratching the surface on what that means.
for our listeners, explain that just a little bit more. So you're saying Laramidia is the west coast of what is the western island of North America, because it was bisected by the Western Interior Seaway. And that was swamps and rivers and estuaries. You're saying that in 20 acres that you'd find five different ceratopsian species, different ones in a very small area, because you'd find them in the fossil record very close to each other. You'd excavate and find species one here and 100 yards away, species two, that type of definition?
Yeah, so let me set the scene. Laramidia, Western North America, tiny fraction of the size of North America today. And these dinosaurs and all the things that live with them were sandwiched between the Western Interior Seaway to the east and the rising Rockies, Laramidian orogeny, whatever, in the west. And so it's this coastal plain, and you could be up in Alberta and Montana and go to a place and find a set of four or five different species of these kind of almost elephant-sized animals living in the same place. And we know
coexisting in the same time frame.
Coexisting. And then you can go down to Utah, and I had the honor of really kicking off a lot of that research in Grand Staircase.
Right, yeah.
The monument, and we've now got at least four coeval species there, as far as we can tell. And you have to ask why and how, because the thing about horned dinosaurs is, with a few exceptions, if you take off the top of the skull, you can't even tell them apart. Like, the skeleton
right.
identical, the jaws are pretty much identical, which means the only thing that's really different between them, and there are exceptions, but for the most part, the only thing that's different between them is all the bony bells and whistles, the horns and frills and hooks and spikes. And
wow.
So those things are about mating more. They're not about fending off predators.
Defense. Come on, you're telling me a sharp horn on the is not about defense?
I mean, rhinos don't first and foremost use their sharp horns for defense. They'll use them. And it's there.
I've seen it.
I'm not trying to say they absolutely do use them,
right.
But rhinos also use those horns for jousting, for
right.
each other around.
And a big Brahma bull.
If you look at the evolution of horns and horn-like structures, including antlers and things like that, they are first and foremost about competition for mates, and secondarily, sometimes about fighting off predators.
Wow.
Well, my question, as we research this, and I'm a lifelong dino guy like yourself, as we just mentioned, but I had no idea really that the ceratopsians, the ceratopsidae, were restricted to Laramidia, really, because even over in Appalachia, there's like hardly any record of them at all. And they're not down in South America. They evidently came from Asia initially. Is that?
Well, let's start with the very first evidence of a frilled dinosaur, a ceratopsian.
Like Protoceratops,
yeah,
right?
Protoceratops. Is that from the Jurassic?
Asia.
Or
it even goes earlier than that. It goes back to the Jurassic, but there's these cetacosaurs, which also were part of that horned dinosaur family, and they probably have their origins in the latest Jurassic or early Cretaceous. And then they radiated out. It wasn't till the end of the Cretaceous that we see any evidence of these large ceratopsids, the big horned dinosaurs. And we don't know. I mean, we don't know for sure where they evolved. There's a lot of evidence that they probably evolved in North America. The oldest ones are in North America.
Oh.
The Chinese example is from the later Cretaceous. They could have gone over then.
Was there a land bridge?
Yep, there was a land bridge that appeared at that time, and there was an exchange.
Alaska.
Yep.
Of course.
They walked right over Ray's house.
So any evidence of other species that are doing the same thing in the late Cretaceous, like predators? Oh, hadrosaurs. Okay, so
yeah.
So they had multiple species coexisting in the same strata?
Yep. There's more horned dinosaurs.
Now, I say strata because that's how you find them, in the same strata, right?
Yeah. You know, Dinosaur Park is an example. There's multiple species of duckbills and horned dinosaurs in Dinosaur Park, and the same in Grand Staircase.
My question is, what are they all eating, Scott?
That's a really good question, Ray.
We have to ask a paleobotanist, don't we?
Well, no. I think he hangs out with a paleobotanist or two. Dr. Scott, what do you say?
Kirk Johnson and I have had this conversation a number of times, and it's really interesting because flowering plants evolved in the Cretaceous. They showed up in the early Cretaceous and diversified. And somebody you've had on your show, Robert Bakker, came up with this idea that dinosaurs invented flowers.
Yes, I drew the picture. I love the idea. But what does that mean? What do you mean?
Well, it just means that all species, they don't just evolve, they co-evolve. So they evolve with other organisms in their landscape. And if you're a plant eater, you co-evolve with plants. And you impact those plants, and those plants impact you. So it's not so much that dinosaurs invented flowers,
right?
Co-created each other, I would argue.
I love that.
And so that going through the Cretaceous, you see the rapid increase of angiosperms, these flowering plants, so that by the end of the Cretaceous, they're kind of everywhere. And then ultimately, they kind of take over the world because they're fast growing. They recover quickly if they're disturbed. So you can eat them and they can recover. They can grow from their roots. They can do all these things that non-flowering plants struggle to do sometimes. And so I think there's a fair bit of evidence that horned dinosaurs, they had their teeth were just for slicing. They couldn't chew. And it seemed like duck-billed dinosaurs. So they would just put food in their mouth. They'd slice it up into smaller bits and they'd swallow it whole. And the digestion really occurred down in the gut. They didn't do much processing in the mouth at all. So they probably had a really fibrous diet because there's no other reason to have hundreds of teeth in your mouth at any one moment that are evolved into a blade to cut through
and
things.
And the smoking gun, are flowering plants fibrous?
Some are, absolutely. So again, I think our evidence, the paleobotanical data in many respects is lacking for a lot of these places. Like the two best known ecosystems from the lake, maybe the three. So there's the Hell Creek, which is, the Maastrichtian in the very end of the Cretaceous. But the other two before that are Dinosaur Park and now Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, both Campanian. And we have pretty good floras, but not great. Like we still really have a good idea about what the landscape looked like. We know there was swampy areas and drier areas, but we knew that before we found any plants. So there's still a lot of unknowns. The way I like to say it is that dinosaur paleontology really went through a long stamp collecting phase where here's this new thing, let's give it a name and we'll put it on a stamp. And then, we've actually done that. And now we know enough about the dinosaurs, we know enough about the plants, we know enough about some of the other animals that they lived with, that we can now start to create food webs and think about what the ecosystems were structured like and how they changed over time. But what this means is, we have entered a whole new realm. We can now think about the world of dinosaurs in a meaningful way that was completely inaccessible to us even 20 years ago.
I got to say that, I grew up in the stamp collecting era, in other words, this is a dinosaur, this is cool, its name is this mounted. But really, in traveling around with our mutual friend Kirk and riding along with him for years now, knowing him for 30 years, it's the world in which they inhabit. And, then hanging out with a paleobotanist, it wasn't about just that bone. It was like, wait, what are they eating? What's the plant? This is a whole world that is here that you're looking at. And so it brings up all these interesting questions. And I'm curious, Dinosaur Park, super diverse. Like you said, all the stuff.
In Alberta.
That's in Alberta. And then Grand Staircase, very diverse. So my question to you is, at the very end of the Cretaceous, in the Maastrichtian, when that asteroid hits, there's arguments as to how many are, is it a rich fauna? Are these ceratopsians, the ceratopsidae, the triceratops, and its few friends? Is it a weak ecosystem, or was it thriving on the very day the asteroid hits?
You mean all of them? All of these different diverse species?
Well, I'm just saying the diversity issues are there with whether or not it was a dying world in the late Cretaceous.
You're asking, is the late Cretaceous a dying world?
Yeah, that's
with the reduction of species.
When you go to the Hell Creek today and you wander around, it's Triceratops, Triceratops, Triceratops. There's some argument that maybe you go south and there's maybe Torosaurus, but is Torosaurus actually a Triceratops? So we have a world's expert here. What is your opinion on the health of the ecosystem at the very end of the Cretaceous?
I think that the latest Cretaceous world was absolutely thriving.
Okay. Does the fossil evidence really support that?
I think it does. And I think, so yeah, were the dinosaurs the same as the Campanian? Were they even the same number of species? Probably not. There was probably fewer. You know, you lost the big crested duckbills, the hadrosaurs. They weren't there at the end of the Cretaceous. You lost some of the diversity of horned dinosaurs. You don't have any of the, what they call the centrosaurines, the shorter frilled ones there at the very end of the Cretaceous. But so what? There's still lots of dinosaurs. There's maybe some fewer species, but still lots of dinosaurs in the Hell Creek itself, and a tremendous diversity of other animals around. That was a thriving, healthy, vibrant ecosystem. And it was doing just fine, thank you very much, when the rock fell from the sky.
Back to the ecosystem and the plant diversity. Is there any Ceratopsidae coprolite?
That's a good question. There have been coprolites found in the Cretaceous. And I think it's hard to tell
where they came from.
Dinosaurs, a duck-billed dinosaur. You can see there's little bits of plant matter, but it's hard to tell for sure. And I've not really seen evidence that shows that we can now put these coprolites into taxonomic categories.
Right.
And you have had the pleasure and the distinction of naming more than a dozen, 18 species dinosaurs.
18? Wow.
Got that here in the data.
Yeah, something like that. And lots and lots of horned dinosaurs. By far, my favorite is an animal that I did not discover, but I had the pleasure of naming. And that is Cosmoceratops.
Yeah. I was leading up to that. I was leading the witness.
It is an amazing looking frill. It almost looks like it has cartoon hairs. Those the top horns are hanging down. They look almost like a bad wig.
Everybody knows Triceratops. Horn of the nose, one horn over each eye. Three horns total. Cosmoceratops blows it away. 15 horns on its head. One on the nose, one over each eye, one on each cheek. And then these 10 weird things across the back of the frill. And there's other bits and bobs on the side of the frill as well. And so it's just an incredible beast. And I felt so lucky to have the pleasure to be the first person to really get to know it.
How big was Cosmoceratops and what was the biggest Ceratopsidae ever?
So Cosmoceratops' skull is between, you know, the reptiles that grow all their lives. So sometimes when people say, how big are they? It's a little bit different than mammals, but probably the adult skull was 5 to 6 feet long in Cosmoceratops.
Wow.
Triceratops, it's more like 8 to 10, sometimes even a little bit further. So Triceratops has the biggest skulls of any land-living animal that ever existed, as far as
Wow.
And so Torosaurus, you mentioned earlier in his Torosaurus and Triceratops, one of my mentors, Jack Horner, who I had the pleasure of working with Montana for a number of years, and I'm proud to still call a friend. Jack came up with this idea that a lot of dinosaurs that we think of are separate species are just different age groups of the same species. And one of them that he put forward with is Torosaurus and Triceratops. I don't buy it.
Torosaurus is defined by the huge holes in the frill, a large frill, long. Huge holes, which are called fenestra. Is that correct?
Yep.
So Horner says it's just an older Triceratops and the bone it melts away for weight considerations. So what are your thoughts on the fact that this is a different species and not just grandpa Triceratops?
I'm not saying that we know for absolute sure, but my bias is, first of all, you find giant versions of both animals that with skulls in the range of 9-10 feet long. And how could they possibly so now you've got these two animals and you're saying they're just different, the same species, but at different ages, but they're at this giant size, which is pretty close to the limits. You have young Torosaurus, they have smaller skulls. So it's not like an old Triceratops. There's a specimen on
And they
exhibit.
do have the holes?
Yep.
All
Specimen
right.
on exhibit in Philadelphia that's smaller. So I think there's just enough out there to sort of say, and I just don't really buy the some of the argument that Jack has put forward. And again, he could be right in a lot of this stuff, but my read of the fossils is different. And so I think that, for example, Torosaurus and Triceratops.
Well, I think it's good that there's people that ask the questions and, you know, provoke the conversation, get the conversation going. So to challenge it. But now what about the idea of sexual dimorphism? Are the males, is there a difference between the males and females? I've seen that
you're saying an
you've
ornate.
You've opined about this. You
an
know,
ornate
that,
frill could be a male and a barren one could
well,
be female?
That's what I'm wondering about, because I think I've read that you don't think there was sexual dimorphism, or am I incorrect, doctor?
It's a very excellent and educated question, Ray.
I try.
So a lot of people sort of ask me like it's a gotcha thing. If I say, hey, listen, these things were for display, then they immediately go, well, hold on. How come we don't see any animals that don't have these ornamentations that
right.
females? Isn't that nonsense then? If they're being used for display, you expect the males and the females to look different. And the answer is, yeah, maybe, but it depends on the kinds of ecosystems they live in. If you think about big herd living animals today, like buffalo in Africa or large antelope, wildebeest, the females and the males look almost exactly alike. You can't tell them apart. So why would they do that? It's because if you're living out in the open and your life is like exposed to the world and all the predators that are out there, you don't want the lions or the theropods going, hey, I think I could pick off that animal easier than that animal. You want to look just like the herd. And so you fit in. And these horns and frills didn't show up in the growth of the animals until they sort of reached puberty. And like they really didn't have much in the way of horns and frills when they're really young, because we have baby fossils of these dinosaurs. They reached this sort of early sort of teenager puberty stage. Then they sprouted all this stuff. So it's about, hey, check me out. I'm the coolest. I'm the best looking. And you guys over there, you need to stay away.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Are there any
you.
Herding animals extant or extinct that have extreme sexual dimorphism?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think there's a bunch out there that have been found.
Like what? I mean, that would kind of kill the lion wanting to eat the female over the male, or vice versa.
No, but again, it depends on the ecosystem. If you live in an open environment.
Right.
Then the males and female, and you form big herds.
Right.
Males and females are going to look alike. If you don't form big herds and you live in more closed forested environments, that's when you're more likely to see sexual dimorphism.
Ah, okay.
So think about mountain gorillas. The males are twice
right.
the size of the females
right.
and all that. But
they don't have any predators, though. But anyway.
Well, that's I love geeking out here on
yeah.
Ceratopsidae.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
And going through all the stuff that we find about Dr. Scott online, you spent a considerable amount of time in Madagascar.
Yeah. How did you get there? Why? And what did you find?
Well, it's fun talking to you guys. It's like walking through my life here.
we'll put you on the couch here in a little bit. We'll talk about what really motivates you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So there's a fellow who was at Stony Brook University, David Krause, who started a project in Madagascar. And very early on, he invited me. I was a recent graduate, my PhD, and he invited me to go with him. And we, Kathy Forster and a number of other pretty well-known paleontologists were out there. And it was one of those places a little bit like Southern Utah, where everything we found was a brand new species to science.
Wow.
And not
wow.
not just dinosaurs, but, you know, fishes, amphibians, reptiles, like everything. Everything you pick up, you can almost say, yep, no one's ever identified this before. And it was just amazing to be in a landscape like that. Where we were working was in the Maastrichtian, sort of latest Cretaceous. And there was just some remarkable things there. One of them was a dinosaur called Majungasaurus. And people had found lots of teeth of Majungasaurus because like all dinosaurs, they shed their teeth, but people have been actually able to measure the rate of replacement. And Majungasaurus had a more rapid replacement rate than other carnivorous dinosaurs. And it may have been because it was a cannibal and it fed on it would chew on bone, because you find lots of tooth marks.
So this was a predator? Was it a theropod?
It was a predator. But the cool part for me, because it's the coolest thing I ever found in my whole career by far, was we knew that this carnivore existed because it's these little teeth with serrations all over them. We know it's a meat eater, but no one had ever found what the rest of the animal looked like. So I could walk out and in a day, I could find 10, 15, 20 teeth, but we had no clue what the animal looked like.
Wow.
We had found a bump from the top of a head that looked like one of those dome-headed dinosaurs or
Pachycephalosaurus.
And they started to say, yeah, this is a Pachycephalosaur, but it was really weird because there's no Pachycephalosaurs known from the entire southern hemisphere. So it was way out of place. And then we looked at it and we thought, we think this might be a carnivorous dinosaur, a theropod, but we couldn't prove it until we found more of the skeleton. And so we went back, and in 1995, I was walking along and I saw a tail vertebra from a carnivorous dinosaur, a theropod dinosaur, sticking out of the hill. And it was, when you dig, you guys know this because you've been out on digs, it is nothing like that initial scene from Jurassic Park where they go and they get the brush.
Oh, there it is. Yeah.
Like you're digging for weeks or months to find something. The one exception I've ever experienced in all the places I've been around the world was this place in Madagascar. And you still dug, but it was never deep below the surface. It was never hard fossilized. The bones are light. They're not even really permineralized, really. And there's certain places where you can get your brush and brush down and find
just like the movie.
And so on this particular day, I found this tail vertebra. I brushed and there was another one, and I brushed and there was another one. I dug into the hill a bit and it was moving. And I thought, oh my God, we've got the whole skeleton of this big carnivore. No one's ever seen it before. And we dug again and there was a leg bone. And I thought, that's it. This is the femur. I got so excited, and the thigh bone. And then we exposed it all, and my heart just dropped because it was the thigh bone of a giant sauropod dinosaur, one of the big dinosaurs, not a carnivore at all. And I thought, it's just a big jumble. It's a bone bed. We're never going to find this big carnivore. And then literally a half hour later, I had my hammer and pick, and I did a little tunk, 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 and lifted up this chunk of rock. And beneath it was a beautiful upper jaw maxilla with the teeth in it. Staring back at me, and it was the first time this thing had seen the light of day in better part of
and it's called what is it called
Majungasaurus.
What's the name mean?
You said it was a cannibal. How do you know it was a cannibal?
This means the lizard from Majunga, and Majunga is the closest town nearby.
Nice.
The Majunga lizard. And then like 5 minutes later, I found another bone and another bone. So the whole skull was there and it had just fallen apart. So we collected every element. We were only missing one bone from the palate. Otherwise, it was complete and undistorted. Wow. And when we got it back to North America and we made copies of the bones, they literally snapped back together like
like a Lego.
How big was Majungasaurus? How big a theropod?
Yeah, so the skull is, about 2.5 feet long.
Wow.
The animal is about 30 feet long. The original is now... it's on display. Majungasaurus is on display at the Field Museum in Chicago, where I was just a week ago. They have another little animal from that same area called Mashikasaurus.
I was going to ask you about that one. And
wait,
it's kind of cool.
You mentioned cannibalism?
Yeah.
Well, everything eats everything, Dave.
Okay.
Especially those.
All right, you're right.
The theropods are going to, Tyrannosaurus
sure.
are going to eat their babies. Crocodiles eat their babies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Mashikasaurus.
Mashika is the Malagasy word for vicious.
Oh.
So Mashikasaurus means the vicious lizard, and the species name is Knopfleri.
And why is that, sir?
Knopfler, as in Mark Knopfler.
So dire straits.
The vicious lizard of Knopfler, named after Mark Knopfler. And it goes back to when we were digging in this one quarry. We would play music sometimes because you're bored and you want something. And so, and you're doing this really tedious work. And so we would play music. And when, just as serendipity would have it, whenever we played the music of Dire Straits, we would find bones of this new little carnivorous, sort of raptor-like carnivorous dinosaur. And so, you know, late at night in camp, there might have been a beer or two consumed. I can't really remember.
There may have been. You can't remember, yeah.
And somebody said, hey, we're always finding these bones when we're listening to Dire Straits. Why don't we name this after Mark Knopfler? And everyone sort of went, cheers, and, oh, that's a great idea. And we get back, we write the paper, we publish it. It makes the cover of Nature, and we call it, you know,
Knopfleri.
Knopfleri, the vicious lizard of Knopfler. I reach out to Knopfler through his agent.
I was going to say.
And he's very happy about it, and he sends me 12 tickets to a concert in New York City.
Wow.
So I took the crew, and that was wonderful. But then when it was actually announced and it came out in Nature, the British tabloids got a hold of it, and they accused me of either naming it after him because, A, he is a rock dinosaur and outdated.
And all. Oh.
Or B, he is ugly and buck-toothed because this thing had teeth.
Oh my God.
And
that's,
it was just like how it goes, right?
I am really over people calling things that are outdated dinosaurs, because they were absolutely successful. And they ended because of a stroke of bad luck, not because they were unsuccessful.
And by the way, there's still more dinosaurs around than mammals.
That's right.
Just a quick question before we leave Mr. Knopfler. So it did work. You were able to actually kind of go to a concert. Did you get to hang out with him a little bit?
We never did get to hang out with him.
All right. Well, the other question is there a particular Dire Straits song that you kind of associate with that dig and that dinosaur? A particular one? Because I'm a rock nerd, too.
Yeah, and I know that about you.
That's a no. He didn't. He couldn't come up with it.
There's not one in particular. We
the
actually,
whole album. That album was like in the 90s.
There's so many. So many cuts. But
listen anyway. To multiple albums, so it wasn't really.
Well, send it to me later. But
all right. So, let's talk about how to get outside, go into nature, and make your own discoveries. Which,
as a
fellow parent, I was blown away by your passion, Scott, to help children, to educate children, to change the world. And if I'm not mistaken, did you say in an interview that the Academy of Sciences' goal is to regenerate Earth?
Regenerate the natural world. Yep, that's what we do.
Wow. That's a tall order. Explain what that means.
Well, do you want me to do Dinosaur Train or do you want me to do the Academy?
Well, I think there's a segue between the two.
Yeah.
There's a segue between the two. Dinosaur Train to Wild Child to the Academy. Yeah. Go.
Okay. In 2005, I walked away from the paleo nerd dream job. I was a tenured professor at the University of Utah. I was cross-appointed with the Natural History Museum there. We built a brand new, beautiful Natural History Museum that I was involved with. And
where was that?
In Salt Lake City. And I had Grand Staircase, these amazing fossils, not to mention Dinosaur National Monument and all these other places, within like 3, 4, 5 hours drive. And I walked away to nothing. And most of my colleagues thought I was crazy. But I did that because as much as I love dinosaurs, I felt like the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And me being on an academic treadmill, trying to get grants and publish papers and, you know, I'd name new dinosaurs or whatever, wasn't going to allow me to do the things in the world that I wanted to do. And I'm not criticizing paleontology or paleontology.
I understand, yeah.
And so I didn't even know what that was. And I moved with my wife to California. She just completed her residency in medical school and was starting life as an anesthesiologist. So I got to California and I said, well, what the hell am I going to do with myself? And I did writing. I did speaking. I did a book. I started consulting with museums. But then one day the Jim Henson Company called me up and they said, hey, we're going to do this kids show on PBS about dinosaurs, and we're interested in you being the science advisor and maybe the host. Would you be interested? And I said, well, tell me about it. And they said, well, it's going to be dinosaurs and trains. And they told me the story. And I said, whoa, 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 you can't do that. And I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, you can't go take dinosaurs and stick them on trains like it's the frickin' Flintstones. Like, people and dinosaurs didn't live at the same time, at least not these dinosaurs. And I don't want to be part of creating any myth around that. And they said, no, "Don't worry, Scott. We're only going to put dinosaurs on the trains." And I thought, oh my God, that's just brilliant. Holy cow, that's like chocolate and peanut butter, you know. If you're 5 years old, that's as good as it gets. So I said, okay, that's really interesting. I really like to get involved, but I have a request. I won't do this unless you let me encourage kids to get outside into nature, because the last thing I want to do is create one more thing to addict kids to screens and prevent them from going out.
Now wait, as a fellow parent, is this because you experienced the screen addiction with your child like I did with mine?
And my kids, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I just seen it happening around the world, and I was working on it. I started to write about it. So they said, okay, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to have a tagline at the end of every show, which is what you just mentioned, Dave. And it was my wife, Toni, who came up with the line that I eventually used: get outside, get into nature, and make your own discoveries. Now, at the time, we had no clue if a television show could encourage kids successfully to turn off the TV and go outside, but it actually worked. And it worked so well, and the demand was so high, that we ended up gearing the entire Dinosaur Train series, which was over 100 episodes, around connecting kids with nature. And that was so successful that there were spinoffs like The Wild Kratts and other shows for kids that also started to connect kids with nature. So to me, that was the greatest victory of Dinosaur Train. Not only that it fed all these kids who had a passion for dinosaurs, but it got them interested in thinking about the larger natural world.
I love how you get the kids to say the hard dinosaur species names, and some are very successful and some are very toddler-like. Yeah, it's really a well-produced television series.
I'm just going to say, ever since then, it's amazing. I go out and give these talks, sometimes to 300, 500 kids. And of course, everyone wants to come up at the end. And sure, they want to come and say hi and all that, but they also want to tell me what they know, and usually why I'm wrong about something, which is they think, yeah, like I have this knowledge. I know way more than Dr. Scott does about stuff. So it's pretty
cool. Yeah, they engage you and they want to ask you, they want to stump you too. And you got the fire going. So is Dinosaur Train like it's done?
The way it goes is that we do a season and then it goes away for a while. And then the Henson Company says, hey, we're going to do another one. It's now been a few years and I think we're done. And I'm actually good with that. We did over 100 episodes. It was airing daily in over 100 countries around the world for most of that decade. So I still get mail from Argentina and the UK, like from all over the world.
And you covered almost every dinosaur too, even the weirder named ones.
I was looking for a Cosmoceratops episode and I wasn't able to find it. Is there one?
There absolutely is.
Come on, Ray.
I missed it.
Ray, use your search functions.
Not only is there a Cosmoceratops, Cosmoceratops is the mayor of Laramidia.
Oh, that is genius. So you got to kind of oversee the scripts and help write the scripts.
It was fun to pull out these dinosaurs. Machikasaurus is in there. There's a bunch of things. It turns out that autistic kids really love dinosaurs because autistic, they can remember all these names and stuff. They're expert at it. And so we found and we learned that a lot of autistic kids were watching Dinosaur Train. So we started to gear some episodes to them. We even created an autistic dinosaur character in the show. And so we had a chance to do really fun things like that and help to feed this population of dinosaur lovers.
So growing out of Dinosaur Train, you wrote a book called How to Raise a Wild Child. Kids in nature. But your TED talk is truly inspiring. You're on a mission to save the planet.
I'm willing to bet that all three of us growing up spent abundant time outside, like just exploring on our own. And when I was a kid, I'd go out on the weekend and I can remember hearing the door lock behind me as I went out, like, okay, bye. I'll see you when the lights come back on, the street lights are on. And that doesn't happen anymore. The average kid today spends less than 5 minutes a day playing outdoors.
Wow.
And they spend 7 to 10 hours a day looking at screens. And so you can imagine what that's doing to their minds, but also what the lack of nature is doing to their bodies. And their health of kids is really struggling. There was a US Surgeon General who said a few years ago that this generation of kids could be the first to grow up and have a life expectancy shorter than that of their parents because they're living these
sedentary lives, obesity, health issues.
Yeah. And they're not connecting with the outside world. And, you know, if we care about wild nature and we want to, you know, help grow the next generation of environmentalists, why would they ever care about the natural world? They never spend any time in it. You know, David Attenborough is absolutely wonderful. He's a god in many respects, but watching TV alone isn't going to connect you deeply with the natural world. You need that firsthand multi-sensory experience. And so I wrote the book as a way to give parents and teachers and other caregivers kind of a manual for how to connect kids
and
with nature. It's called How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature.
Wow. We'll have a link to that on your webpage at paleonerds.com.
In some of your interviews and your writings, you've talked about the extinction of experience.
Oh.
I love that phrase. The way I took it, the extinction of experience, and I guess you had referred to someone else had come up with that term, right, Scott? But was like that hit me. It's like, well, yeah, you know, getting out there in the world, then stopping to experience the world, taking a moment, and you have the acronym NEW, Notice, Engage, and Wonder. I think that artists and scientists really do foster that fascination. And, you know, it happens. It's a lifelong thing. And, yeah, get away from the screens. Screen time versus green time.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And along with experience, the other thing that's gone extinct is the sense of awe and wonder.
Right.
And it's that awe, it's that feeling, that emotion that takes us outside ourselves and makes us feel like we're part of something bigger. And that was something that was a daily occurrence for most humans in most of the 300,000 years that humans have been around. And it's a rare occurrence now because it doesn't happen if you live indoors and you think of nature as resources rather than relatives. You know, as commodities rather than communities,
well,
whatever.
Indigenous peoples around the world think of resources as relatives, as spirits.
Right. And I believe we need to get back to that way of thinking. And I'm working on another book right now that's about that notion, about how do we shift the human worldview so we see ourselves not as outside and above nature, where we're managing the world, which is the dominant view now, but rather we see ourselves as deeply and inextricably embedded within nature. And we've got these millions of other species that are just waiting to help us regenerate the planet if we just align with the way ecosystems work rather than, you know, trying to butt against it all the time. And so that transformation has yet to occur, and that's the movement that I would really love to help build.
I know we're about to, maybe we have to wrap it up here
Answered my question, my big question I was going to ask you, but we'll get to
Let me ask you one more. You are the director of one of the West Coast, actually one of the world's most incredible museums. It's a huge museum. You find yourself now in administration running these huge institutions. What can museums do to drive social change? How can a museum actually get kids engaged in nature besides just looking at it in a museum setting? How do you get them out there into the world, Scott?
The jury is still out on whether museums can become powerful tools for regenerating the natural world. I think it's as yet to be shown. Museums are, in many cases, sort of halls of wonder. People walk in and go, wow, at the blue whale.
It's a trigger,
Or whatever it might be. But in terms of connecting people deeply with nature and helping them see themselves as embedded within nature, that still has yet to be, I think, really proven. We have taken the California Academy of Sciences and we've said, we don't want to be neutral. We want to have a powerful purpose. And to my knowledge, we're really the first purpose-driven museum of nature in the world. And our purpose is, we talked about it earlier, to regenerate the natural world. That's why we exist.
Well, the actual
we don't want
physical grounds of your museum are sustainable with solar panels and all the earthen structures and
all that. And so we don't want people to see us as a building in Golden Gate Park, San Francisco, which is how most people think about museums, as infrastructure. We want people to see us as a powerful purpose, and our mothership through which we deliver on that purpose is the building. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has successfully done this in Monterey, California, You don't think about them first and foremost as a physical structure. You think about them as an organization that's protecting the oceans. So we want to do the same with regenerating the natural world. And the notion of regeneration is important just because sustainability doesn't go far enough. Sustainability is about holding on to what's left of the world. Regeneration says, listen, if you look outside, no matter where you are on the planet, you're looking at a degraded ecosystem compared to what it was 50, 100 years ago, let alone 10,000 years ago. And so holding on to what's left isn't enough. We need to regenerate these ecosystems and make them stronger so that they can be healthy and resilient in a warming world.
Brilliant.
Scott, if you could go back in time, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you want to go back to, and what precisely would you want to see, sir?
Ray, this is something I've thought about. No surprise, right? And I think I would go back to where Grand Staircase Escalante is in southern Utah, and I would go back 75 million years. And I would do that because we've had these interdisciplinary teams working there for many years, and they have unearthed a complete, what was basically an unknown ecosystem, and put it on par with any other ecosystem in the whole Mesozoic. And so I've studied that ecosystem. I've imagined it. I've put the pieces together and thought about what the food webs would look like. It's part of my DNA because I've studied it so much. And I could be completely wrong on how I imagined it. So to be able to go back and actually see what these animals look like and what it felt like. You know, if you've ever been to someplace like the Serengeti, it's not like there's big animals all over the landscape. You can be places and not see a single animal. And all of a sudden you go over a hill and there's multiple mixed species herds, and it's incredible. I think it would have been more like that, but we don't know. I would love to be able to go back and see and feel that hothouse world that is incredibly diverse. And the thing we forget about here in the modern day on Earth is that everywhere used to be full of these giant animals, like all the continents, you know?
Yeah.
And we've forgotten that. And we think about Africa as an anomaly, but right here, where I was in San Francisco, you know, mammoths, mastodons, saber-toothed cats, giant ground sloths, and it was only 150 human lifetimes ago. We forget that we live on a planet that's meant to have these mega beasts all over the place. I would like to go back and see one of those ecosystems that's full of mega beasts and experience it firsthand.
And any particular animal you'd like to see up close? Your Cosmo?
Yeah, I'd probably have to go see Cosmoceratops.
Brilliant. All right.
Wow. Cool.
Well, I'm so glad I wrote two questions today. I don't know why. So I'll pretend I'm not reading this, Scott, but given that deep time is a challenging concept for many people to grasp, and I've tried to explain a trillion sunsets back to the Cretaceous KPG event. Sorry, 24 trillion sunsets, I think is the number. But you suggest that our conservation efforts should be planned on the scale of centuries and millennia rather than the more familiar decades of time that we all can reference. How do you recommend we approach the issues of climate change and biodiversity loss through this lens of deep time?
So we all suffer from a little known condition called what I like to call severe temporal myopia. We have these blinders on, and we think of time at most going back from our grandparents to our grandkids. So like on the order of a century is our understanding of time today. It's not true of indigenous cultures around the world who have a much deeper time perspective and don't even experience linear time the way we do in many cases. But my bias is, as long as we're stuck in the present, then the future is not really relevant. We don't even need to respect the future humans, let alone all the other creatures that are going to exist on this planet. We can just go and milk it for all we want today. And so we have to break through that. And the way to do that, I believe, is to understand how your place has changed through time. And we're going to do this in San Francisco. We're going to work with people who do artificial reality, augmented reality, virtual reality, to be able to depict what this place looked like when the Pleistocene megafauna was here, when the indigenous Ohlone were here, and what it might look like 50 or 100 years from now. And the whole point is to break people out of this temporal closet that we're in so that we start to see ourselves as actors in this ongoing drama and as agents of change with the ability to impact the future. And this applies to all humanity, but in conservation in particular, so much of conservation is just about, well, you know, there used to be some grizzlies or some wolves here in California. Let's let some wolves come back. And you go, well, okay, that's not really going to cut it. Wolves had an ecological function. They kept the populations of herbivores in check, which then kept the plants in check and allowed them to grow and do their thing. We need to bring back as many elements of that extinct fauna as we can. And I'm not talking about bringing back de-extincting mammoths and mastodons, but even to go back a couple hundred years and think about bringing back grizzlies, for example. There used to be 10,000 grizzlies in California at any one time. Let's bring grizzlies back onto the landscape and see how that works. And it can work. Big bears are present in Europe all over the place now.
Well,
more than
present throughout the Sierras as in the black bear population.
They're present where I grew up in British Columbia.
But how do you get the people?
And in my backyard,
yeah, and in your backyard. So. But how do you get the people who say, I don't want a grizzly taking my dog or cat in my neighborhood in, what do you call it, French Camp, California?
So if you think of nature as just a bunch of resources out there, a bunch of dead matter, then that's a problem. And so as the more that we can start to embed people in these places and start to, people to understand that these animals are alive, the better off we're gonna be. One of the things I like to do when I'm talking to scientists, and it sometimes ticks people off, but I'll tell you this and feel free to use it, is I'll say to people, so how many of you accept evolution? Now, they're all evolutionary biologists for the most part. So they all go, yeah, okay, we accept evolution. We don't believe in it. We accept that evolution has happened and all species carry a common ancestry. Okay, so how many of you can look out the window and see those birds and those trees and feel them, experience them as your relatives? And then they look out the window and they kind of look down and they don't really know it. And they're going, man, and I go, right, you don't do that. So why is that? You believe it, you accept it, but you don't experience it. And the reason you don't experience it is that we are victims of this worldview that separates us from nature. And we need to put ourselves back in it.
That's it.
Well, I'm like waving my fins in the air. Yeah. I keep reminding people our kinship with fish, you know.
We need to teach everybody that we are part of this ecosystem. We are not above it. We are not the lords of nature, but we are part of it.
Yes. We need to respect the natural world and treat it like it is. It's our kin. And as I said, they are waiting to help us. Yeah.
I've been thinking about, Dave and I need to maybe come up with our own catchphrase, like your get outside, go into nature, make your own discoveries. And I've been thinking the past explains the present and helps to predict the future.
Yeah. There we go.
I don't know. I wrote that down before the show.
That's good.
Deep time will blow your mind. You can't spell evolve without L-O-V-E.
Okay, and can we get a t-shirt with that there, Ray?
But anyway, Scott.
Fantastic.
Truly, this is a transformative interview.
And you know what? We're
going to
have some some links on your webpage at Paleo Nerds that will point to the passion that you share about these subjects and the fact that you want environmental sustainability, you want to help children, you want to help the world. I just love people who want to leave the room a little better than when they found it.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you guys. Congrats once again on getting the word out about fossils in deep time.
We're going to keep on going. And I'm going to be at the Museum of the Rockies standing in front of that huge display of ceratopsian skulls and frills in a couple months from now. So
just for the frill of it. The frill of it, yes.
Oh, let's hang up on that one there.
Oh, sorry.
That was great, Ray, I have to say. Thanks, Scott. It's an honor, and thank you for being on Paleo Nerds.
Thank you, guys. It has been a joy, and wishing you all the best in the next steps of your journey.
Well, that was enlightening, and I love Triceratops and Ceratopsians.
Ceratopsidae.
That was Thank you.
I think he corrected us on that one. But anyways, no, I told you that, he's passionate. He's passionate. And actually,
when you
dove into all the research, you found that out. There's a lot of his thoughts out there in the world.
It's amazing. And he just wants to change the world for the better. And that is fantastic for him to use his position and knowledge. And he can actually facilitate change.
Well, you get these platforms, and he's had the PBS show. He's a museum director. He's doing science too. But I love the idea that, you know, we're just so stuck in this view of our own very limited lifetimes, temporal restriction. And, you know, if we look at it in a deeper sense, and as he said too, if you could look out the window and see your relationship, you know, to animals, to creatures, to the world, and really feel it, you know, they'll believe in evolution, but can you feel it? You know?
Yeah. Do you remember Sam Gunn, when we did the interview with him, that he mentioned that the ancient Hawaiians looked on various plants and animals as relatives? So they didn't just, you know, slaughter animals and denude forests. They treated them with respect because they were relatives. So that kept their ecosystems sustainable.
Well, yeah, you know, there's these deep cultural links to nature too, you know. We came from the natural world, but now science is really showing us there is science behind all of that. So it is this study of the world and this knowledge that we all agree on universally. That's what science is. It's a truth.
But my problem is, how do
you may say you believe in it, but
how do you teach the average person who, when they want to go to the grocery store, they leave their driveway and then there's a big, huge boulevard of McDonald's and Target, and you go past Lowe's and Home Depot and you get to the giant Safeway or whatever grocery store, and you just don't see it. You see no ecosystem out there. You see cement and signs and gas stations.
I'm in Alaska, where we don't have that so much.
No, Alaska, living in the middle of it, dude. You're living in the middle of a National Geographic documentary, where, right outside your window, dude.
Yeah, there's the bears in the backyard. The way you do it, Dave, is, you know, I mean, we're doing our own little part.
Is you do it through screens, which is...
Well, you try to get their attention. Right? Try to get people's attention either through storytelling or like a profound statement that might stop somebody in their tracks.
But the alternative is through watching a David Attenborough documentary. So how do you get that person, which are many in the Western world, far removed from nature and rarely go
get up off the couch. Take a moment.
If you have a backyard, there's great ecosystems. You can start there.
And Scott says that in a lot of his talks too, you know, you think you're so separated from nature. No, just it's there. And if you got a backyard, you don't need to go into the deep woods. Take a moment in your backyards, get down on your hands and knees and see what's in the grass there. And, you know, there's...
And I'm going to plagiarize and end this episode by saying, get outside, go into nature, and make your own discoveries, as per Dinosaur Train and Scott Sampson. All right, Dave, signing off from Ojai, California, where a mountain lion grabbed two hikers' dog, and the guy bared his own teeth and approached it with fury, and the mountain lion dropped the dog and is fine now and without any pathology or problems.
Yes, nature will find you. And the doggy's okay?
He's okay. Yeah, totally okay.
All right. Well, okay.
The guys are shaking
up. Well, they got a story to tell. They got a story. Oh, yeah. My dog was attacked by a mountain lion. Well, I'm sitting here in old Ketchikan, Alaska, where the skies are gray and they're predicting snow tomorrow.
As usual.
Snow. Yeah,
really?
Snow.
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah. All right.
You don't have to shovel snow.
Get out your skis.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. Peace out, man.
All right.
See ya.
See ya, Ray.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know each episode is paired with pictures and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a long, long time.